Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Phil Latzman. We'll stay sunny through the rest of this afternoon around the valley. Look for a high temperature to land in the mid-80s. Pretty similar conditions for tomorrow. For Sunday, sunny skies again, maybe slightly cooler, and then a possible weather system heads our way early next week. Currently with relative humidity at 9%, it's mostly sunny and 80 degrees at KJZZ. In traffic, a disabled vehicle on the 101 southbound in the East Valley at the 60. Also a collision I-17 northbound at Northern. Another I-17 southbound at Greenway, which is restricting the off-ramp. 21 people have been indicted in a weapons trafficking case that stretched across Arizona and into Mexico. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk, Michel Marisco has the story.
The gun-running ring is accused of attempting to smuggle 100 weapons and about 80,000 rounds of ammunition into Mexico. A federal grand jury alleges that 21 people started buying the guns in Glendale in early 2015. According to the 30-page indictment, the ring bought rifles and handguns in Glendale, Phoenix, Apache Junction, and in Tucson. These were what federal agents call straw purchases, where one person buys guns from a licensed dealer for another person. So far, 19 of the 21 people named in the indictment have been arrested. Michel Marisco, KJZZ News, Tucson.
The Arizona Diamondbacks are throwing Maricopa County a curveball. The team is threatening to sue and leave the downtown Phoenix ballpark if the county doesn't pay for repairs and upgrades in the future to the now 18-year-old Chase Field.
In a letter to county leaders that became public yesterday, the Diamondbacks accused the county of failing to take responsibility for $187 million in future repairs needed for upkeep for the stadium. Diamondbacks president and CEO Derek Hall says they'd prefer not to leave, but need to explore their options just in case the stadium isn't properly maintained by the county.
What could this building look like in 12 years? That's what scares me. You know, we want to make sure we always have the most fan-friendly, state-of-the-art facility in baseball, and they've made that very clear through their comprehensive annual reports that it's their obligation to make this as state-of-the-art as they can.
Hall was asked by reporters yesterday what was wrong with the current stadium, which has been open since the Diamondbacks' inaugural season in 1998.
I agree, the stadium is nice, and we want to make sure it is through the life of our deal. So if that's in jeopardy because they can't fulfill the $187 million that they've identified and brought to us as a need that they're responsible for, that's my concern. I want to make sure the stadium looks as good today as it does 10 years from now, and I want to make sure that it is still a state-of-the-art and fan-friendly then.
The letter also states that if the Diamondbacks determine a retrofit of Chase Field is not feasible, and if the county does not grant permission for the team to look elsewhere, they would pursue legal action. The Diamondbacks Hall contends the Maricopa County Stadium District is responsible for funding Chase Field's capital needs and improvements.
No, it is their responsibility. You know, when they come to us again with that $187 million figure and say we can't fulfill that, we don't know what to do. And so for 3.5, 4 years, we've been trying to find that solution for them and bring them a solution privately. It's sad that we came up with a pretty good solution of just let us go out and look right now. And at the end of the day, we may end up back here at Chase, which is where we prefer to be, but we need to see what's out there before it's too late.
County officials say taxpayers built the ballpark with $238 million in sales taxes. And those officials say, according to the contract with the county that runs through 2028, the Diamondbacks are prohibited from trying to move until 2024. Joining us now is Maricopa County Communications Director Fields Mosley and the director of the county's stadium district, Darren Frank. And welcome to you both. So what was your initial reaction when you first found out about this letter?
Well, the original letter that came to the board offices last week was quite simple, a simple paragraph asking to be let out of a portion of the contract so they could go and visit with other entities who might offer them a stadium opportunity. The board was given an April 1st deadline. They responded by Wednesday. Darren hand-delivered the letter to the D-backs stating, no, we can't let you out of this portion of the contract in an effort to protect the taxpayers. That is why that clause was put in the contract in the first place.
And Darren, what was your initial reaction when you had heard this and then were asked to get out of this particular contract?
quite frankly, surprised. They have been over the years asking for certain things, reduction in rent, namely one of them, but never have they asked directly for any sort of amendment to the agreements that we've lived with for the last 17 years.
There seems to be a bit of a he said, she said going on here with the team claiming that you're responsible for the $187 million in upgrades. You guys said that the team is. Can you, from your perspective, clarify that for us?
The number that Derek Hall is using, 187, roughly is from the 2013 facility assessment report that the county does. We've tried to do it every 2 or 3 years, and how we use that is as a guiding document. We've never used it to force the Diamondbacks into any sort of repairs. We hope they use it as a way to track what they've done and how they're doing things. It also does have some assignment of responsibility to Maricopa County Stadium District, mostly on concrete structure and life safety. Of the, let's just say, $180 million, very clearly Maricopa County Stadium District is responsible for $30 million in concrete structure and life safety, and that number could go up.
County manager who you work for was the part of the negotiating committee that, as chief financial officer a few years ago, negotiated this deal with the Diamondbacks. Could you and could have he expected this to come to this so soon?
I don't think anybody expected this to come to a head so quickly, and we're really not sure why the timing is now. Mr. Manis has made it clear in the last 4 years since he's been the county manager, he's had numerous discussions with the D-backs about primarily rent reduction. They pay approximately $4.2 million annually to rent Chase Field. And the numbers that Darren is talking about, those things are paid for with the rent. That money does not go back into the general fund of the county. That goes into the stadium district and is approximately $16 to $18 million right now. That is money to be spent on the structural needs to make sure the field is a great place to go and see a baseball game and is safe for the fans who are there.
Do you think that this is just kind of posturing on their part to see what they can get at this point? And would you foresee in the future them really making good on a threat to leave downtown Phoenix?
You would have to ask them why they are doing this right now. We can't answer that for them. We were surprised by the vitriol that was in that letter that came to us at noon. It included the attachment, which was the letter they had drafted in January. We had heard rumors about that letter. We had never seen it until afternoon yesterday. And that we were surprised that it had come to this so quickly. We know that they weren't happy with the rental agreement. We know that they would like fewer seats in the stadium at a cost, I've read, $100 to $200 million perhaps. That was not going to be paid for by the county taxpayers again. The county taxpayers have already spent more than $240 million on this stadium, and I think we've received great benefit from the stadium and this relationship with the Diamondbacks, and the Board of Supervisors wants this relationship to continue, but we're going to have to get over this bump in the road.
And Darren, how do you do that now? Life's negotiations. What happens now?
I think you return to the original agreements. They've governed the relationship that we've had for the last 17, 18 years. The answers are in there. Every one of the answers, every one of the questions, they're in the agreements.
Darren Frank and Fields Mosley from Maricopa County. Fields, thanks very much for your time. And Darren, thanks for coming as well.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Drama surrounding the Arizona Corporation Commission continued this week as Commissioner Andy Tobin is facing more allegations related to potential conflicts of interest. KJZZ's Will Stone has been covering the news and joins me now. Will, where do those potential conflicts stand and what could they mean for the commission this year?
Yes, Steve. Former House Speaker Andy Tobin, who was appointed early this year by Governor Doug Ducey to replace Commissioner Susan Bittersmith, who had to resign amid allegations that she violated conflict of interest rules. When he was appointed, we learned that his son-in-law works for Solar City, which is a major rooftop solar company that has a lot at stake in a number of rate cases involving power companies this year. And so there were already questions of whether or not he could rule on those kind of cases. But then it came out this week that Tobin also has another potential conflict. His brother works for Cox. He does commercial timing. So he works on the TV side of Cox. And if you remember, this question actually came up with Commissioner Susan Bittersmith, who did some work with the TV side of Cox. The commission regulates the telephone, telecom side. But either way, it turns out Tobin did not disclose this at first when he was appointed to the governor, and so we're just learning about it now and trying to understand what that may mean.
And what is Tobin saying about what other people are calling conflicts?
Tobin is pretty much saying this is all an overreaction. He makes the point that both of these are relatives. These jobs, he emphasizes, do not have any budgetary or managerial roles. They're working class jobs, to quote him. And he pretty much says these are remote conflicts of interest that shouldn't preclude him necessarily from ruling on cases involving, power companies and solar or necessarily Cox. Now, it's important to note that he hasn't made any votes on any of these kinds of issues yet. So we're still waiting to figure out what ultimately he will decide. But what he told me yesterday was that he hasn't ruled out the possibility of voting on either of those issues because there's a number of legal opinions.
Now, some people are calling on him to resign.
That's true. If you remember, Tom Ryan, who's the local attorney who filed the complaint against Commissioner Susan Bittersmith last year, he has called for Tobin to resign, pretty much just saying that we need someone who has their hands clean of any possible conflict, and that's the best thing for the commission. And also, Bill Mundell, who was a former commissioner and is now running again for the commission this year as a Democrat, he has called upon Tobin to step down and for for someone to look closer into these conflicts.
And Will, finally, what's going on with the actual work of the commissioners, what they were actually elected to do? They're in the middle of the first in a series of highly anticipated rate cases, right?
That's right, Steve. There are five big rate cases this year, and the first one is for a small utility. It just serves two counties in Arizona, Mojave and Santa Cruz. It's called UNS Electric, and they are pretty much seen as coming up with a template for possibly the other rate cases this year. So it's being highly watched. It's been going on. Hearings have been going on all month. There have been public hearings as well. There's a lot of consumer opposition. Not only are they trying to raise rates for all customers, but they're also trying to implement something known as demand charge, which would essentially tie consumers' bill to the peak hours when a customer uses the most energy. And a lot of consumer advocates and ratepayers are saying this is really anti-consumer and unfair. The utilities say, they're adapting to a changing world, and that this is probably actually could help consumers if they just are educated and learn how to use them better. And all of this could have implications for solar, because some of these customers are rooftop solar customers. And we are expecting that how the commission decides on this case could set a precedent, for example, for Arizona Public Service and other rate cases.
KJZZ's Will Stone with an update on the Arizona Corporation Commission. Will, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
More than 50 years ago, the Voting Rights Act was signed into law in the attempt to prevent racial discrimination and voter suppression efforts in 9 states, including Arizona. As part of the VRA, those states needed to get pre-approval or pre-clearance from the federal government for any voting rules changes. But the provision strictly focused on pre-clearance was wiped out on a 5-4 vote by the Supreme Court in 2013. A number of people in Arizona, especially on the Democratic side, have argued that the thousands of people who were standing in line Tuesday night, hours after the polls had closed, wouldn't have been in that situation if the full Voting Rights Act were still intact, because that allowed Maricopa County to cut its polling places for the presidential preference election from 200 down to 60.
I don't accept Helen Purcell's apology. I would accept a resignation. It's just an extreme injustice.
I went out to eat late and I was thinking, I wonder if those people are still voting. I went there at 11:30 and I have pictures. There were still almost 60 people there. Those people probably didn't vote till 1 a.m.
For more than a decade, Tammy Patrick was the federal compliance officer for the Maricopa County Elections Department. She now works for the Democracy Project in Washington, D.C. And I turned to her for more information on the VRA and the decisions made by Maricopa County. Tammy, should there have been more voting centers open on Tuesday?
I have spoken to election officials all around the country that use vote centers. And from the math that I've done, with just the understanding of how many people were eligible for this election, I don't think that 60 was necessarily an incredibly bad job of deciding how many to use. I think that in a pilot like this was, they maybe could have erred on having a few more. But really, election officials all across the country are being caught off guard by kind of the tsunami of turnout on both the left and the right for both Democrats and Republicans.
Tammy, let's go to the Voting Rights Act and the DOJ preclearance, which no longer in effect, and the Maricopa County Recorder's plan to reduce the number of polling stations. Would that have passed DOJ muster if the provision of the Voting Rights Act were still in place?
So I did all of the preclearance to the Department of Justice. I was their federal compliance officer from 2004 until the formula under Section 4 became defunct and the county was no longer covered. I think that the vote center concept would have certainly been pre-cleared. I think that there would have been, of course, a review of how many sites and where they were located, and I'm sure that the administrators at Maricopa County did a very rigorous review and felt that they were providing, you know, the services that the electorate would need at that time. So I think that it probably would have been pre-cleared. There may have been some slight adjustments depending on the feedback of the community and stakeholder groups, but I think that the number, the kind of 60 wasn't, you know, an abnormal number to settle with.
It appears that that extra level of scrutiny, if that were present, it at least would have helped the perception.
The way that the Voting Rights Act moved forward under Section 5 that was positive is that any change that was going to be implemented was reviewed prior to having voter impact. So, for instance, a law that would change a photo ID or, you know, anything along that line, it would be thoroughly reviewed and go through the courts and the litigation and the determination of whether or not it was retrogressive prior to ever touching a voter. So when Section 5 went away, now everything has to touch the voter first, and then you have to have injured parties and you have to move forward.
Tammy Patrick, former federal compliance officer for the Maricopa County Elections Department. She currently works for the Democracy Project in Washington, D.C. Solar power has become a battle across the Southwest. Homeowners are creating their own power with rooftop panels, and some large utility companies are complaining that creates unfair costs for everyone else. Now that argument is playing out in one of the most obscure elections in Arizona. The show's Lauren Gilger hit the campaign trail on her bike with one candidate to find out more.
Nick Brown has knocked on more than 2,000 doors in the last few months.
Ms. Lorenz, yes. I'm Nick Brown. I'm running for the SRP Board of Directors.
He picks a neighborhood and bikes from house to house, asking for votes in his bid to serve on the board of the Salt River Project.
And because you're a homeowner here and
his door-to-door campaign means he's been barked at by a lot of dogs.
How are you?
Good, good. How are you?
They absolutely would lick you to death.
I'm sure.
Campaigning is never easy work, but this campaign is a little bit harder than most for one simple reason. Not very many people seem to know that there even is an election.
It's probably an election you didn't even know was happening.
No, I didn't know it.
It may be an election you didn't even know exists.
Nope.
Salt River Project, or SRP, is a public power utility and the state's largest water provider. It was formed in 1903, and each division, water and power, has a board whose members are elected every 2 years.
The Garcias are next.
The number of people who vote in these elections is almost impossibly low. Out of more than 600,000 eligible voters, about 4,000 votes are usually cast. That's a voter turnout of about half of 1%. And that makes it an uphill climb for any challenger looking to unseat an SRP board member. Many current members have served for years and come from families with ties to agriculture in the state. Fred Ash, the member Brown is trying to unseat, has been on the board since 1980.
I do think that, broadly speaking, it's to the status quo and the incumbent's advantage to have less participation rather than more.
But last year, the board made a crucial decision to raise rates on rooftop solar customers. And now, a pro-solar clean energy ticket, including Brown, is organizing to run against Ash and other board members.
Mr. Gazzolo, I'm Nick Brown. I'm running for the SRP Board of Directors. I'm committed to bringing more solar energy to more rooftops in SRP territory, mm-hmm. which is, in some ways, the opposite of what the Standing Board has done over the last year or so.
I'd say so.
Brown says he spent most of his career working for clean energy. He came to Arizona to be the Director of Sustainability Practices at ASU. Now he works as a consultant.
I don't think they're going to successfully make a transition from where their energy sources are now to a clean energy future with leadership that they've got now, frankly.
They want to make some changes. Well, good luck if they get on, because I've been trying to make them for 30 years, and it's a slow process.
That's Fred Ash, the board member Brown is going up against. He said he was surprised to face opposition in this election.
We have spent in the last 10 years over $142 million subsidizing solar.
Ash voted for the rate increase on rooftop solar customers last year, but he's also the reason the rates were not retroactively applied to people who had already entered into 20-year leases with SRP.
I was the one who thought, you know, I don't think that's fair.
For his own campaign, he says he's reaching out to family and friends and asking for their votes, just like he has in the past. But traditionally,
it's something that people really don't care that much about.
And it's complicated. To vote in an SRP election, you have to be a homeowner in SRP territory. Some board positions are voted for based on the acreage you own. You have to request a ballot from SRP, and there are actually two elections, one for the board that oversees water operations and one for the power side of SRP.
It's just not the solar people are trying to figure this out. We've been trying to figure it out for decades.
On to the next.
On to the next.
For Brown, getting on the board would be the beginning of a conversation about clean energy and a way to take SRP in a different direction.
And the longer they hang on to programs and policies that deny its progress, the more challenging it's going to be for SRP to remain viable as the industry changes.
And he says this is his chance to do something concrete.
For me, it's purely developing an opportunity to make a difference and to accomplish some things that otherwise I don't see getting off the ground very soon. Mr. Babbitt.
Yes.
I'm Nick Brown. I'm running for the...
Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. President Obama was in Cuba this week.
In a world that remade itself time and again, one constant was the conflict between the United States and Cuba.
His visit was filled with the promise of a new relationship between the nations.
I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas.
One front in that Cold War, a program designed to encourage Cuba's medical professionals to migrate to the U.S. by offering them visas, could be on its way out as well. For decades, the Cuban doctors have come to the U.S. seeking a fresh start and hoping to pick up where they left off professionally. But for many of them, it has meant sacrificing their career. From WHYY, Carrie Barber has the story.
Buenos días.
It's an early morning at Advance Care, an adult daycare in Cape Coral, Florida.
Julia, buenos días.
Anya Rodriguez, who owns and runs the place, greets an arriving client with a cry of mamito. Holding the woman's face in both hands, she kisses her on each cheek, then takes a seat at the Domino's board with two older women clients. Her bright red manicure flashes as she mixes up tiles for a game. Rodriguez started her career caring for people as a surgeon in 1991 in Matanzas, Cuba, 30 miles dead east of Havana.
The compensation in Cuba for do the doctor is nothing. So the people that want to do the doctor, at least in Cuba, is because they like it.
Although she did love her work and the prestige of being a respected surgeon, she found the political environment in Cuba untenable.
I don't have the choice to be free.
In 1999, Rodriguez won a visa lottery to relocate permanently to the United States. Her plan was to join her longtime boyfriend, Michelle, who'd come to Florida 8 months before, and find work as a surgeon. But her dreams hit a stumbling block. To work as a doctor, foreign medical graduates must show proof of graduation from a U.S.-approved medical school, pass a three-part licensing exam, and complete a minimum three-year graduate medical training known as a residency. The same is required of U.S. grads. Rodriguez says she passed the first of those exams, but then got bogged down in what she found to be a daunting and confusing process. To compound matters, by that time she had had a baby and was working to put food on the table in a new country. All in all, Rodriguez says it was just too much. She stopped pursuing the license.
You know, since I was 12 years old, I realized that I didn't want to live in that way.
Leonel Cordova, a Cuban-born pediatrician and emergency medicine doctor practicing in Miami, did manage to pass the boards and get licensed. Cordova and his wife, a dentist, came to the U.S. in 2000 after being granted political asylum. Back then, he saw firsthand how many of his fellow Cuban doctors struggled to recertify, so he and some colleagues arranged an informational meeting for them. They expected about 200 people. 2,000 showed up. He remembers having to close the doors against the crowds.
There were a lot of people outside, all of them Cuban physicians that had absolutely nothing to do at this moment with the medical field, and they were willing to do whatever it takes to get it. So that was really a shame.
Cordova does not want to see Cuban doctors get special treatment. He believes everyone should meet the same standards, but he can't help but think a compromise may be a good idea.
I think we are missing a lot of the great opportunity with the Cuban physicians. They should have a different status, and they should be able to work the same way that the nurse practitioners and the PAs, because you know what? Those are really people that know what they do.
The pipeline of doctors arriving from Cuba each year has only increased since 2006. That's the year the U.S. Departments of State and Homeland Security implemented the Cuban Medical Professional Parole Program. It allows Cuban medical personnel who are working internationally to be fast-tracked for U.S. citizenship. Not only does this serve as a brain drain on the Cuban economy, it's also a black eye to a nation that prides itself on its doctors. To date, more than 7,000 healthcare professionals have been approved since the program's inception.
So in many ways, it's a con trick.
That's John Kirk, a professor of Latin American studies at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
First of all, to embarrass the Cuban government, and secondly, to get medical personnel to come to the U.S., but there's very little infrastructure to help the doctors and the nurses and the technicians once they get there.
Statistics show how difficult it can be for many foreign medical graduates to meet the U.S. requirements to practice medicine. About 94% of U.S. medical school grads were placed in residencies in 2015. But the total percentage of graduates of overseas medical schools placed in U.S. residencies hovers just around 50%. And those the Cuban Medical Mission Program brings to the U.S. may have even a higher hurdle. Not only is there a language gap, but Cuba watchers say, since the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, their textbooks and medical techniques have not been updated. Back at Advanced Care, former surgeon Anya Rodriguez is busy growing her successful enterprise and making a good living for her family in another facet of the healthcare industry. She employs about 38 people and has plans to expand soon.
I have money in my pocket because I'm working for me in the best country in the world.
But even with all this, she hasn't given up her dream to get back into the operating room someday.
I need to have the knife on my hand doing surgery to be really happy.
That's Carrie Barber reporting for our partner show, The Pulse at WHYY. For years, Apple has made its product launches into huge events with media members wanting to be the first to see the new phone or MP3 player and report on and review it. One of those happened earlier this week. But does that put journalists in an odd position? Are we giving the company a free advertisement, even if we're not covering the launch in strictly positive terms? To get a deeper perspective, I'm joined by Al Tompkins of the Poynter Institute. Al, how should media outlets go about covering this sort of thing without coming across as overly promotional?
One of the things I would ask is, has every single thing you've ever said turned out positive? I mean, do you ever take time to critically look at whatever it is you're covering? So the question would be, if I looked at the last 2 years of product reviews, would every single one of them be some sort of glowing report? Or did you step back and say, there's something about this that, it wasn't so fantastic. Part of the problem with that idea is that you could find yourself being artificially critical just because you feel like you're being too positive, and that's not fair either. Of course, another question would be, do you in fact have any commercial connection with this product? And if so, you have to disclose that.
The feeling is that any coverage off the bat, because it will in some ways be promoting a product, even if you're not saying anything good or bad about it, that's sort of built into it. So do journalists have to concede that territory sort of to begin with? Like, that's, all right, here's a beat. I realize people are going to say that, you know, we're covering this. Some people might say, why are you even covering this at all? And ultimately, no matter how you cover it, at least some people will look at it as, well, you're giving them free publicity anyway.
Well, I think you have to explain why you cover things that you cover. There ought to be some way for you to be able to say why this is news. Just tell me. Tell me why it's news and why you think this is worthy of coverage. Why is Apple more worthy of coverage than Samsung, for example? If there is, in fact, a big invention that a lot of people seem to be interested in, if it actually moves our technology forward in some new way, then there's a pretty good chance that people are going to be interested in it. I mean, say what you want about Apple, they have created some new categories. Whether or not you like their product improvements or not, year to year, they have created new categories in some very interesting ways.
When it comes to something that is ultimately a product launch, do journalists have to then ask questions maybe unrelated to that particular product launch to say, well, in the case of Apple versus the FBI, would it be important for journalists to ask questions that are related to other aspects of the company?
The Apple versus the FBI is an interesting one because it cuts both for and against the company's reputation, depending on sort of how you see it. I think the viewers, the readers, the listeners will judge us over time. Our content emerges not in one story, but in 50 stories in a year, 2 years, 5 years. And that's one reason why online can be so useful, for example, to a radio station, because you can put down a collection of stories on a page and help us to aggregate this topic. We can see what you've done over time. And if you find yourself constantly covering a product launch, for example, step back and say, why are we covering this? Would that be apparent to our listeners, for example, why we're covering this? Do we need to explain this to them in order to be forthright and honest?
And I'll one final question for you related really more to the product launch aspect. Phoenix seems to be a test market for a lot of things. McDonald's may try their all-day breakfast here in Phoenix. They may experiment with it, or Taco Bell might do something like that. Should journalists look at those slightly differently than perhaps a technology company?
What you may do is look beyond the event to what this actually means. You know, is all-day breakfast somehow indicative to our work habits or to our dietary habits or even to our to whether we got enough money in our pocket to buy something more expensive? I mean, so what does this actually mean sometimes can be a really useful question. Why would they believe that this now is time for this product? What does this mean to the fast food industry? Who are they trying to catch up with now? Who are their new competitors? Sometimes I think we get so caught up in the what that we stop there when the real story could be the why.
Al Tompkins is a senior faculty member at the Poynter Institute. It's a new tradition for people to gather in southern Arizona for a three-day conversation about issues affecting the border. As KJZZ's Stina Sieg reports, they don't just connect through words, but through dance, art, and food.
And music. So much music. Like these wooden panpipes being played by a group of smiling, dedicated people, who also happen to be newbies at this.
Precioso. Magnifico, buenísimo. You got it, guys.
That's their instructor, Ana Maria Vasquez. She's one of the many musicians, artists, and activists who teach at this creative experiment called Common Ground on the Border. It features dozens of classes, performances, and field trips, all with the same goal, to get people to understand the borderlands, its complex issues, as well as its beauty. With her panpipes and supportive energy, Vasquez is trying to get her students to really feel this place without reading a book or sitting through a lecture.
I think art has a way of putting it inside people's heart without people noticing.
That's the idea crackling across all the classrooms here at the Good Shepherd United Church of Christ in Sahuarita. It's Common Ground's home since it began in 2014. The church is about 50 miles north of the border, but like many people here, Vasquez doesn't recognize that separation. She says all the countries on this continent are really just one, cut up by artificial lines.
An artist, and all of us have artists inside, must bring those visions to life in whichever way we can do it.
Like leading people in protest songs from days gone by. That's Ted Warmbrand playing a few classrooms over.
We all have a part of us that's outside the box.
Warmbrand says art and song are a good way to access it. That also gets people out of their comfort zone, which Warmbrand hopes is just the beginning of something bigger.
It reminds you that when you're doing things together with people you didn't even know, it feels good. And it actually is something you might want to do again. And if it's not singing, it might be building a house together or getting a march together or starting a school or an orphanage.
Or learning to make tortillas or folklorico dance, both of which you can do at Common Ground. But you can also travel into the desert and watch as activists drop off water for crossing migrants, or go into Mexico and visit a small building where migrants can get a meal before they try to cross. The spot is run by upbeat nuns and surrounded by lookouts for drug cartels. Common Ground isn't trying to whitewash that complexity or any of the issues on the border. Instead, Good Shepherd Pastor Randy Mayer says he wants people to see this area through a new creative lens.
There's no other place like this in the whole world. Where you have a first world nation crashing into a third world nation, and there's energy and possibilities that you don't find other places.
Mayer acknowledges the limits of this get-together, how it's smaller than he'd like, from between 70 to 90 people this year, depending on the day. Mayer knows it tends to draw the same mix of like-minded people, typically white, older attendees. But even if Common Ground is simply preaching to the choir, Mayer thinks its message about the vitality of border life is still needed and hopes people will share it with others when they go home.
People should be grabbing hold of what's down here and saying, this is incredible, this is beautiful, this is something I've never seen and I really need to learn more about it.
And they can every spring in this small town on the road to Nogales, Mexico. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, reporting from Sahuarita.
If you're a parent, you've probably seriously considered getting very involved with your child's school in some way. Maybe it's to provide public service for something you really believe in, or maybe it's because you've been frustrated by some school-related issue. Let's say that itch to run for a school board has to be scratched. You could turn to the Arizona School Boards Association, or ASBA, which will be holding a webinar next week. It's part of a campaign called Do You Have What It Takes? Become a School Board Member. Karen Loftus is Director of Leadership Development for ASBA. Karen, how often is someone interested in serving on a school board for strictly personal reasons?
Well, certainly there are people who become interested in school boards because of a situation in their life with their child or a family member. The other side of the coin, though, are those people who are at a time in their life that want to give back in some way. And looking within their community, they either find that education is important to them as a person, or maybe they look back on their family or friends or children and say, this is an area where I could give back.
How important is it for a school board member to be someone who at least thinks in terms of consensus building?
Consensus is a really important concept because in Arizona, for example, most of our governing boards are 5-member boards. So it's an odd number. And so in any case, the majority up for whatever the vote under discussion is, the majority leads the direction that the district's going to go. And so it is important to vote their mind based on the data that they've been provided and the information they've researched that's come to them. And sometimes that means their opinion changes after they've learned that information, but it is about voting on behalf of all the kids in the district.
I presume this is not a one-size-fits-all necessarily, because boards in different districts and different parts of the state may have different challenges.
We have a very diverse student population here in the state of Arizona. And whether that be our rural and remote locations or whether it be our urban locations, we have children that have a lot of different needs. And so some of the similarities are certainly things like making sure they have the resources on hand to do the best that they can for the children, right? But certain things can look different as well, and part of that might be based on the demographics of their students and or their community. It could have to do with what's going on in the school right now as far as perhaps legislation or something else that is impacting the local community. But it really starts with a heart for wanting to be there for the right reason.
What are some of the most common questions that you and ASBA get asked about this?
That idea that sometimes people that are running for the board office, as you mentioned before, feel like they want to be there for a reason, whatever that reason is. And the one thing that I think always, at some point, do they realize is that that board member is one vote. And the power of the governing board is when they're at a convened meeting voting on whatever it is they're voting on. And that is where their power is. That is where their influence is. And outside of the boardroom, and I literally mean physically outside of the boardroom, their power is no different than you or I.
We have had in Arizona a few prime examples of folks who were school board members and moved on to much higher office. I think of Tom Horn. I think of Jan Brewer, even Diane Douglas right now. Mm-hmm. How often do we see people on boards who have greater ambitions?
I think that there are people who get into an environment and realize what that enables them to be a part of, and they realize that they want more. And so it doesn't surprise me in the least that after being on a governing board, some people have a desire to run for other political office. On the other hand, I do think that there are people who are looking at the bigger picture on the front end, and they're trying to figure out how they can get their foot in the door.
Karen Loftus is Director of Leadership Development for the Arizona School Boards Association. Karen, thanks very much for the time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sonder is a word you may not have heard before. Don't grab your dictionary to look it up because it's not in there. It was made up by a man from Minnesota and is now the title of a new ASU art exhibition. The show's Annika Klein spells out the story.
Sonder. You are the main character. The protagonist, the star at the center of your own unfolding story.
That's John Koenig defining the word Sonder in a YouTube video. It's a word he made up as part of an ongoing project called The Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows. Koenig says he makes up words for the parts of the human condition that we all feel, but don't have the words to describe. Sonder, Koenig says, is the realization that each random passerby is living a life as vivid and complex as your own.
It's a fundamental part of empathy. To look out at the world and see all the lights in the city and realize that those are actual people.
Now that word Koenig invented in 2014 is the title of an ASU exhibit.
It really ties into our gallery-like theme about how we see people and how everybody has different lives and we don't know what their experience really.
Hitomi Baba is one of seven art seniors who will display work in the exhibit. She says she wanted to capture snapshots of human emotion in her watercolors.
That's what I'm kind of aiming for, is it's like a still shot of something that will be continuous.
Like that moment when you see a stranger and notice a frown on their face. Azalea Rodriguez will show charcoal drawings, many of them purposely including sketch lines and smudges. She says she's using the physical form for the theme.
Every body is different, and I think that goes along with like realizing that everyone's different. Even though the word is meant to be more of like a psychological type thing, I think that it can be applied to the physical form too.
You could have a feeling of Sonder when you're in a crowd and realize no two bodies are alike and each has its own scars. John Koenig says he thinks it's great the students have found a way to interpret the definition and relate it to themselves.
And I think that's exactly what words are for, and that's why, you know, I'd be happy if Sonder ended up becoming a real word. Because it means something to people, not because it's been blessed by some some linguist or included in some dictionary, including my own. That's, I think, how words become real, is if they mean something to people.
The Sonder exhibit will be at ASU's Gallery 100 starting April 4th. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
The taiko is a Japanese drum, and Valley musician and Japanese native Ken Koshio is an expert at playing it. But he's also expanded his horizons by trying his hand at string and wind instruments, and he's focused on bringing different cultures together through music. On Saturday, April the 2nd, he'll provide some examples of that with Taiko and Roll 2, Yin and Yang at Tempe Center for the Arts. And he joins me now. Ken, why is the taiko or any other form of percussion important in your music?
Any indigenous people has a drums. That's maybe also our heartbeat. So for me, when I started to play those drums, to express maybe even really, I don't maybe, you know, conscious of some kind of deep side of me. Seems like it's awakening. So that really gave me the chance to play traditional drumming and drums, you know, styles. So now it's really my main instrument. But now I combine each other even with the native music, because those really organic music combined together makes us, or makes me at least, you know, like earthy feeling.
Ken, can you give us some samples of some of the instruments you've brought?
Okay, sounds great. So this one, you cannot see, but this is a snakeskin body from Okinawa, Japan. We call Sanshin. But also at the same time, we can do rock and roll too. Whatever. Something like that.
A little smoke on the water from Ken Koshio.
Yeah, thank you very much. And also I brought the traditional bamboo flute. It's called the fue.
I'm not sure everyone would say this, but yes, it does seem like there's an inherent spirituality mm-hmm. when we think of Native American music,
yeah,
when we think of Asian music right. as well. Is that something we read into it as listeners when we hear it, it makes us feel a certain way? Or do you think there is something inherent in that because of the older traditions in many cases mm-hmm. of those cultures?
If you go to Grand Canyon, even, you know, nearby here, Camelback or some mountain or even lake, you can hear the sound of, you know, blowing wind or even the sound of the, you know, like leaves of the trees. So I think that's a reality of the acoustic music. So relating to that, so we Japanese say that drumming of the taiko is the same frequency or feeling of our heartbeat. But at the same time, before we were born this world, Tammy of your mom, you listen to her heartbeat. The most important thing is we can put our emotions in it.
Now, you're a very collaborative musician. You work with people who work in totally different kinds of music. Uh-huh. How important do you think that is as far as bringing cultures together?
You're American. You are born here, right? Mm-hmm. So yes. I was born in Japan, and always I look up to American, you know, pop scene or Hollywood movies. So, but I couldn't speak in English because I was born and raised in Japan. So studying in English, junior high and high school, but still I didn't know how to communicate like today. For me, music is an absolutely great tool to communicate.
Valley musician and Japanese native Ken Koshio. He'll be performing with a number of other artists on Saturday, April the 2nd at Tempe Center for the Arts. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.